Thanks for downloading this IMSA Radio podcast. It's for personal use only and must not be broadcast, reproduced, or used in any form without permission.
Tell your friends they can get their own copy by visiting IMSAradio.com or search for IMSA Radio wherever they get their podcasts.
So back to green flag racing after our eighth full course caution. Renger van der Zander trying to make his way away from the hordes behind him. It's not very far until he's going to catch some cars up who dived into the pits trying to make up laps on their category leaders. Austin McCusker for Riley Motorsport, I think, will be the first car that the train catches up. And indeed, he gets out of the way at turn six. That was a smart move. Here comes the 48 car. Now on board, Kamui Kobayashi in the Cadillac, right underneath the rear wing of the Whelan car, going down the inside of Almendinger into the bus stop. We've seen how good Kamui is down there. It's a lovely piece of driving, and he has gone through that. Nick Dearman, was copy boot stuff from Kobayashi.
Yeah, brilliant. I mean, it's yeah,
cool. You need a help as well.
You need a little help for the person letting you through, and they're going, that's fine. But you know, the point about it is that now, following with Van der Zander, Van der Zander has got two choices now. He can make a fight of it, or he can sit in the slipstream half a second behind, saving fuel. And that's the other option you have. Kobayashi may want to lead because he feels happier being the first person to see and not having his space blocked by another Cadillac in close proximity. And that's what can go wrong. That was the
Volt Racing Aston Martin.
Oh, Aston, yeah, yellow. Yes,
going into turn three, the international hairpin, as Kamuika was trying to go around one way, the Aston moved because he was trying to move out the way. But it's Renger van der Zander now from Kobayashi, scored in second with Almendinger in third. And yeah, I agree with that. That's what I can see on the track.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, it's debatable, but especially in this train of DPIs we have, it's debatable as to, you know, where you want to be. And I think it's personal preference. You know, certainly the guys in the middle of the train are saving fuel because they could, you know, slipstream up. They don't need to. They can ease off the throttle. They can coast into the bus stop. They can coast into turn one slightly. There hasn't been much fuel saving. No one really seemed to have seen the need for it. We've seen what seem like identical cars in identical sessions doing 20, 21, 22 laps. So it's really interested to know how this fuel strategy is being run, but it's obviously nothing they're going to tell us while the race is still going on.
3.5 miles around. It's not as if this is a short lap either. Let's keep our eyes, Nick and I, here in the Hackney Global Broadcast Centre. We'll keep our eyes on the track action. She was steer with the battle for the lead in the tri-oval at the moment. Kobayashi's got a super, super run on the leading car. Down the inside, there's contact, and Kobayashi goes around. Kobayashi got there, but not quite enough. And he'll have flat spotted, I think, those Michelins a little bit. Oh, my goodness. Van der Zander gave enough room, but only enough. Kobayashi had to really get out of that. There was a tiny little touch, and as so often happens, Nick Dearman, a beautiful run off the tri-oval. Kobayashi seemed in position, but then ran his left-hand side Michelins onto the dirt and actually pushed the lead away. There was a touch, but it was initiated, I think, Nick, by Kobayashi just dropping the left-hand side Michelins onto the dirt at the start of turn one.
Optimistic. Van der Zander didn't know he was going to do it and came across, and just enough, when Kobayashi moved in, he then hit the rear left on the dirt, and there is no grip on that dirt, and he then tried to brake, of course, the rear end.
There was a touch.
And round he goes and back. And there was a small touch, but I think what you'd say a non-damaging touch, more a touch that gave momentum for the car to go in the wrong way. I don't think either of those are going to need big fixes. The question you very rightly raised, John, is has he flat spotted that set of tyres?
He may have got away with it, because he was, by the time he was on the brakes hard, and then he was sideways and stopping. So he may have got away with that if he was off the middle pen. He's a very experienced operator. This from John Love from Michelin. As you know, America's race, the Daytona 500 coming up here in a couple of weeks. The race leaders, 3 laps ago, completed the Daytona 500 distance. Or 500 laps, rather, of the road course. Now, that totals 1,780 miles. That is an average speed, including the cautions and the pit stops, of 118 miles an hour. And with 9 hours still to go, or just under, 1,000 miles remain. So the old distance of Petit Le Mans before it became a time-sensitive race, 1,000 miles to go. And the computer says 800 laps will click off, so we'll be short by about an hour. So we've had about an hour. We're going to be an hour short.
Fortunately, coming together cost Kobayashi 16 seconds, John, which is, when you saw how spectacular it was and what could have happened, to get over 16 seconds, it's good driving, bad driving to get in the position in the first place, good driving to get out of it with the minimum damage to the car and the tyres, but in the scheme of things, as long as he is pointing in the right direction, nothing's fallen off like a straker or a bit of undertray, he'll forget about that one by the time we have our next yellow.
So that battle for the lead has calmed down a bit, but there's always something else to look at. So let's head into GT Le Mans, where Tom Milner, the Corvette in the number 4 car, is now in 3rd behind Tonio Garcia and BMW Team RLL lead. And I think that might be the first time that certainly I've said that.
They've all come together, haven't they, again, but on the same process. They were never that far apart. You get a nice full course caution that pulls them together in the train. And my guess is it's just the fact that the BMWs were a little bit swifter in the pit stops, and they've managed to then pull out a couple of seconds ahead. It's not a lot, and you do feel that everything we've seen so far is the Corvettes can get it back if they can be bothered at the moment.
The battle is for third position because James Calado is up to the high side, now down the low side, trying to pull the Kobayashi. Doesn't get that done through turn one, and the left and right of turns 2 and 3, traffic ahead of them, including first and second in their class, so they'll hit the traffic first. Ferrari just looks a little sharper coming out of the corners, Nick, at the moment, and James Calado seems to be able to pick and choose his line a little more. He's moving around behind Tom Milner for that scrap for third spot. Number of people asking about the Corvette's engine, saying that they feel, obviously listening in on 107.9 at the track, they feel it sounds a little different from the C8R from last year. I'm not aware, Shea, that there's been any major change in the specification of the Corvette from last year to this.
No, I would agree with that. As far as I know, the season ended in Sebring in November. They were testing with their new drivers beginning of December in Sebring. Same car, same everything. I can't think of anything different on the car, but I'll consult the wise Ryan Smith for answers.
Excellent.
On that.
Very good. Now, we were going to talk about penalties a while ago, but things got rather exciting. 3 penalties, one which I think that pretty much any of us could have called, that was the track services incident, yeah?
Yes, so car number 7 has been given a drive-through penalty for failing to drive with caution in relation to track services, and quite a few people up and down the pit lane have actually expressed their surprise at the lack of severity in that penalty, but that was race control's decision. We've also had penalties for car 52, which, yay, means car 52 is back out on the racetrack. That was the Nicolas Pierre car that stopped in turn 3. Penalty for running the light at the pit exit. That's a stop plus 60. And another penalty that came off the restart for car number 6, that is the Mjolnir Motorsports Duquesne LMP3 machine, a pass under yellow, which necessitates a drive-through. So race control is very busy right now.
So at the moment, the top 4 in GT Le Mans are all on the same piece of racetrack. GT Daytona, Phil Ellis for the Windward Racing Team, is 0.3 of a second ahead of Raffaele Marchiello for Sun Energy One, the Mercedes. And in third, it is Matteo Cresoni. And they are separated by less than a second, those three cars. And I'll try and tell you where they are on the track at the moment. Ah, just coming out of Speedway Turn 1 into Turn 2. So down through the tri-oval lap battle. Now, I said at about 47 minutes past the hour that we'd be looking at the first vestiges of light in the sky. So we've been past that now. So this is pre-sunrise light that we're seeing around the speedway right now. 11 minutes past 7 is when officially... Sorry, 13 minutes past 7 is officially when the 13 hours and 11 minutes of night at sunset and sunrise ends here. Now, this is going to be interesting. The BMW that leads GT Le Mans has cleared a little GTD scrap on the infield. Through goes Antonio Garcia. Tommy Milner needs to get through quick sharp because the Risi Competizione Ferrari of James Calado is right on his tailpipes. It's the right Porsche that is there at the moment, doing exactly what they should do: stay on the racing line, let the faster cars find their way past. And that is Jan Heerlen behind the wheel of that car. And the Ferrari just held up for a moment, but has the Mustang sampling Cadillac. Maybe I'll get a bit of drag from that car as it goes down into the braking area for the bus stop. So that's just broken up that scrap for a moment or two. And Phil Ellis now has a massive lead in GT Daytona. The Wynnewood car's fully half a second ahead of Raffaele Marchiello, has pulled out 4.5 tenths on third place. And Matteo Cresoni, two AMG GT3s and a Ferrari 488 battling there. So Shea and Nick, I'll start with you. Another hour of racing completed, heading to the clock hour of 7 a.m. and breakfast time at Daytona. And you know, honestly, really, if I was being absolutely forthright, I don't think we've really found very much more out than we knew 15 and a quarter hours ago, have we?
We've finally had one of the DPIs trip over another DPI. They've been swinging past each other, both in the pits and on the faster parts of the speedway all day. And finally, one's tripped over another one, but it was a no harm, only a slight foul. So that was good news. No one got knocked out. No, and I think it's interesting. I think you had a nice little reset in this last hour with the yellow. And what we have is a battle in certainly four of the classes. I'm not sure if P2 is going to be a battle or not. But it's bubbling up. And of course, now, after having, you know, 7 or 8 hours of nice solid temperature and air and pressure and humidity, here comes the sun, here comes the change in the track. And this is where we might see where people who have, for example, like the Heart of Racing, Aston Martin, set their cars up for the daytime and may be able to start really producing some gaps and gapping the other cars.
Shea Adam in the classes, LMP2, slightly been blown apart. We have got laps gaps between first and second, but Delvin DeFrancesco is only 8 seconds behind Paul Loupshatten, who, I mean, that era motorsport car back up to second place. That's great news for them.
Yeah, you know, Ryan Dial, we said that he would work his razzle-dazzle magic, and he really has. But Devlin DeFrancesco on his tail, that's going to be difficult for Paul Loupshatten to keep the Aero Motorsport car up in second. But a lap lead for Gabby Aubrey, that's impressive at this stage of the race for the Tower Motorsports Orica.
Shea Adam and Nick Damon have been joining me, John Heindorf, in this section of the race in the Hagerty Global Broadcast Centre. It's been an absolute blast. GTD, Nick, quite clearly, well, there's still three or four cars involved in that. And you can probably say the same about GT Le Mans. The top five, yep, are still pretty much together.
I think what happened was GTD got upset because we were talking about GT Le Mans so much, about how close that was, and they've gone, no, you just haven't noticed we've all come together again in a multi-engined and multi-car fight. And I think if we get a regular spatterings of four-course yellows, this is what it's going to be like all the way to the flag in 8¾ hours' time. Really feel that this race is going to explode. It'll probably do it during Johnny and Joe's next 3-hour session, but or 4-hour session. But I'm already looking forward to coming back to see where we're at in the bright sunlight as we race the flag. And really, at that point, we'll be quite near the end. People have to start thinking, start back timing rather than just reacting.
And we've yet to find out, of course, Nick, which cars are the best when the sun properly comes up. And it starts climbing, and the track temperature, which has dropped down as low as 14 Celsius overnight. It stayed, as soon as the sun went down, a couple of hours after it, it's basically mirrored the air temperature, and that's where it is at the moment. Johnny Palmer is in the Hagerty Global Broadcast Centre. Morning, JP, heading up to 7 a.m. You get to see the track come back to life. And the sun rise and that change in temperature, and what is that going to do to the performance levels of these cars? Fascinating few hours coming up.
It's another pivot point in the race, isn't it? And Nick, I think hitting the nail on the head regarding setup there, because some cars have been designed during the free practice sessions to go well at night, others much better through the daytime and to the checkered flag. But even though we are minutes away from sunrise, they're still nowhere near there, because we've got well over a third of the race to go. It's another milestone. Psychologically, you feel like you're a step closer, but an awful lot more can unfold, and we've seen that many, many times in previous years. I mean, a lot of drivers say you've got to be there or thereabouts on the lead lap into the final 4 hours, and that's where the race starts properly.
I still think the story's to be written here, Johnny. To be honest, the night time is nearly over. That's another little waypoint, really, isn't it, for all of these teams to check off their list. But as our Porsche Keister race said some 15½ hours ago, it's what happens in the last three and a half hours that really counts.
Completely. And you can legislate for being a certain amount in the lead by a certain hour, but all it needs is a caution, and then the reset button is pressed, and that's your strategy right down the pan. And it's, you've got to deal with it. I appreciate this race in chunks, but you can't think too far ahead. It's not like other races that offer a code 60, for example, rather than the full reset. Yes, okay, laps ahead is good. I mean, if you can get laps ahead of your rivals, then they can only ever gain one lap back at a time. And just ask Mazda about that. When they fell three laps down, it's now just two to the race leader, who is Renger van der Zander. Oliver Jarvis hasn't lost faith, nor have anybody at Mazda Motorsports, with Joost looking after matters there, Lena Gade calling the shots. She's no doubt been in this situation before. You don't focus too hard on exactly where you are right now, because it's where you are in 8 hours and 40 minutes. And in 1 second, bang, we are now at the end of another clock hour. So 7 a.m. at Daytona, the hint of daylight appearing in the sky, and particularly as the cars head through Speedway Turn 1, they are really getting a big dose of sunlight now in their eyes, that Florida sunshine, which is unmistakable. Two classic moments for photographers and fans alike at this racetrack, when the sun goes down and when the sun starts to rise, as the 31 virtually leaps over the first bit of the bus stop chicane. It's got Mike Conway at the wheel, by the way, in his Wheel and Engineering Cadillac. Renger van der Zander leads the race by just under 5 seconds from AJ Allmendinger for Meyer Shank Racing. That's the better of the two Acuras currently, but only by 3-4 seconds. The two Acuras are pretty close to one another, actually. Separate entities, of course, one from Meyer Shank Racing with Kerb Agajanian, the other from Konica Minolta Acura. and Elio Castroneves, Brazilian driver, piloting the number 10 in fourth position. Kamui Kobayashi is at the wheel of the Ally Cadillac Racing DPI. That car's fifth, and it's the 48 machine, also with 512 laps completed. And then the slightly larger gap back to Oliver Jarvis, as I say. Four LMP2s. Now, for a long time leading up to midnight and slightly beyond that, I think there was something like seven LMP2s all locked together in combat. So one or two have dropped away. One or two have hit problems, the notorious problems at Daytona. So Gabby Obrey for Tower Motorsport, still well and truly in the hunt, and actually leading, as displayed on my timing screen, by a lap currently. We're waiting for Paulik Chatat to cross the line again to confirm that. But I think the way this timing system is configured, it is a lap between Tower Motorsport and Era Motorsport, with the Dragon Speed machine of Devlin DeFrancesco, 82, currently in third place. And then it's the RWR Eurasia Ligier, and that has Sven Müller doing the driving in this tricky transitional stint between day and night. Conor DeFilippi is piloting the GTLM leading car, which is now a BMW. Remember that for many hours it was a Corvette 1-2. They're not far away from that red BMW, the 25, with Tonio Garcia just 2 seconds adrift and Tommy Milner a second away. So Corvette very much still in the fight, as is James Calado's Risi Competizione Ferrari. Marco Wittmann dealing with a larger gap of a minute and a quarter back to the fifth placed car. And you know, Kevin Estra has been working very hard to gather all of that lost pace back again, or lost position back again. He was down 37th overall a number of hours ago, now back up to 18th place, and all that stands in his way between the nose of his Porsche and the back of Marco Wittmann's BMW are two prototype cars, Matt Bell's LMP2 Wynn Autosport Orica and the LMP3 of Spencer Piggott in the 74 Riley Motorsports car. So that's a tremendous run for WeatherTech Racing and their Porsche 911 RSR 19. They have kept out of trouble after a trying opening few hours and finally getting some reward. They are laps down, and to give you an indication, it is around about 10 compared to the GTLM leader. Exactly 10 according to that graphic, in fact. But psychologically, to be as close as they are to GTLM, I think that's meaningful, just to know that they are steadily climbing the path. And it doesn't take a lot to lose 10 laps if you hit a drama, if you're one of the five cars that is in the mix in GTLM. In GT Daytona, Philip Ellis for Windward Racing, the Mercedes number 57, leads that class from Matteo Cressoni in the AF Corsa Ferrari number 21, and Raffaele Marciello for Sun Energy One Mercedes is running in the number third spot, by the way. So you're tuned to RS2 IMSA Radio, part of the Radio Show Limited network of channels. It will be Joe Bradley joining me very, very shortly as part of the VP Racing Fuels Pit and Paddock report. But before we head to Joe, I'm delighted to say that on the line we can chat to Christina Nielsen, I believe. Aha, you are there. Brilliant. Sorry, I was sounding pretty doubtful there because I wasn't sure that all the technicals were in line. But you are here. Fantastic. How are you, Christina? Because we're getting to one of those that really important psychological points in the race. Sunrise, we're nowhere near there, but you've done well to get this far, I feel, as a team, as a driver, to get to Sunrise is a big step.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, the diffuser came loose here in my final stint. So it's causing a bit of issues about halfway through. So, you know, we were trying to get the drive time done because it fitted with the with finishing that stint. So, yeah, basically just bringing it home, and the guys were fixing it in the pit, and then Kat jumped in. So, you know, we're still there, but we did have our first challenge. But, yeah, what can I say? Luckily, there's still quite a few hours left. So we're still staying hopeful.
That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, you can look at the timing screen at this point in the race and feel, yeah, we wanted to be a little closer to the top 10, for example. But, I mean, I've been saying this about the Mazda crew in DPI as well. They lost, I think, three laps with 8 or 9 hours gone. But you have to concentrate on this one particular stint, this one particular lap, in fact, because you never know when the next caution is going to come out and an opportunity to gain a bagload of time back again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, focus on the things that are within your control, right?
That's it. Control the controllables is the famous phrase, regardless of what sport you're playing. Tell me about this initiative this year, then, attacking the race with a Porsche. I mean, in more recent years, I've associated you with, I think, other manufacturers within GT Daytona. You've raced Porsches before?
Yes, I've raised quite a few of the manufacturers now that's available in GTD. But yes, I did race the previous generation of the GT3R with Wright Motorsport back in 2018. That was a less enjoyable experience. Not with them, but you know, unfortunately, we had an off on the formation lap. So we started the race from the pits, basically, and got back on track like in an hour and a half, 2 hours after, and was completing the 22 hours of Daytona at that point for us.
But you're in quite a good position, therefore, to comment on the ins and outs, the intricacies of quite a lot of the GT Daytona cars in the class. I was mentioning earlier on that a lot of the time in World Motorsport, even if a category is open, then it may tend to just veer towards one particular manufacturer. But GT Daytona never seems to do that. We've got this amazing spread of different cars, and you take a snapshot at the top five or six in GT Daytona, and very often it involves five or six different manufacturers. Is that the organisers doing something very right in terms of the balance of performance and making it fair for all?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Of course, there's always a talk about BOP and balanced performance and doing all the prep work. I think the series does a great job, but I think it's also about creating, you know, big international events that are on people's bucket list that they want to come and do. And I would say Daytona is absolutely one of those kind of races. And I think, you know, the competition level is really high. It's, you know, acknowledged among the manufacturers, among pro competitors. Like, this is a place that you want to be. You want to be in the IMSA Championship and you want to be competing. And that naturally attracts, you know, so many different brands and people from all over the world, I would say.
Tell me how Kat is, because I was due at the start of 2020 to call her debut season back in Europe for the European Le Mans Series. And as I'm sure you know, the test weekend at Paul Ricard did not go well at all for her and pretty much put her out for the season. It's brilliant to have her back at racing again in 2021, but it's been a long road to recovery.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if there was a year to sit out, I guess last year was the worst one.
That's
with
true,
all the
yes.
circumstances, but yeah. You know, we got to have the glass half full. But no, I mean, Kat and I have been spending a lot of hours on the phone and, you know, trying just to do everything that we could to put something together for 2021. This deal with Hardpoint and EBM came together rather late, thanks to VB EnviroCare and Richard Mill. So really grateful to have them on board and being a part of this effort and being a part of showing that, you know, IMSA has diversity and are supportive of, you know, creating an equal playing field for both men and women. So very excited about that, and I very much hope that we can continue it after Daytona, since, you know, we don't want to repeat last year where we just did Daytona. We would like to be back full season, absolutely.
And are we close to being able to announce your plan for the rest of the year? Things presumably are up in the air right now, but you know, the calendar has been obviously released by IMSA, and I guess you guys are working very, very hard behind the scenes to make sure you can do as many races as possible.
I'm going to say yes, we are. And that's about it, what I can share right now. But we're feeling confident and hopeful for the future moving forward.
And is the idea that you and Kat will stick together for as many races as possible, then, as a twosome, and then you will invite others along when necessary?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think both her and I have built up a nice friendship besides the track as well. But you know, on the other hand, it's also a part of showing something that hasn't been done before. I mean, both Kat and I have had a go at the championship. I wanted to give it with Alessandra Bazan back in 16 and 17. You know, she was fighting for the championship in 18. And, you know, we've both done it with male drivers, and we would love to do it as a female duo as well.
I mean, that something that's happening in the World Endurance Championship for 2021 is that, fingers crossed, we'll have two driver lineups that are all female. The Richard Mille Racing crew of Tatiana Calderon, Sofia Flörsch and Bajca Visser for LMP2. And the same goes in GTE AM with stepping up Rahel Fry, Michelle Gatting and Manuela Gosta, who have done ELMS campaigns and now move into the WEC. I mean, I'm a man, right? But it's important. On one hand, it's important not to focus on it because the timing screen cannot tell the difference in genders. The other hand, you've got 5, 6, 7-year-old girls, perhaps at the moment thinking, I can't go into motorsport because it's all men in there. And it needs people like you to tell the younger kids that is not the way we want to carry things on.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's the whole purpose of it, right? On one hand, it's about creating awareness, but also being a part of action being taken and steps moving towards creating more opportunities for women within the sport. And, you know, I think the nice thing about racing is that, you know, while we as drivers get more of the glory, you know, there's a bunch of people on the team that are part of creating the results that are, you know, done together. And, you know, the girls can hopefully one day look up to both if they wanted to be a driver, if they wanted to be a team manager, a mechanic, an engineer. There's plenty of roles that are still quite male-dominated within the world of motorsport, where I would love to see more females stepping up and taking those roles.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Brilliant. Thank you, Christina, for taking the time out to chatting to us. And, okay, timing screen tells us you are in 13th right now, but very much in touch with the next batch of cars. And let's hope after the recent hiccup that you can get some solid running in for the next few hours.
Yeah, we're crossing fingers for some yellows, something that'll help us get back in the game.
I'm sure. Excellent. Thank you so much. Christina Nielsen joining us here on RS2 IMSA Radio, part of the Team Hardpoint EBM outfit. Earl Bamber, of course, the EBM within that, and juggling the driver and the team manager role in car 88. So Christina Nielsen, Catherine Laird, Rob Ferriol, the man we didn't mention, and Earl Bamber represent that quartet. So, in a moment or two, rejoining me in the Haggerty Global Broadcast Centre will be Joe Bradley. That, by the way, was a VP Racing Fuel Pit and Paddock report. And we're grateful to Christina Nielsen for taking a few minutes to tell us all about her race so far. And well-timed, actually, because we're now heading to a new set of pit stops for Renger van der Zander in the Cadillac Chip Ganassi Racing DPI, car 01, and the AJ Allmendinger-driven Meyershank Acura, car 60, also in. Elia Castroneves follows suit, and having already made their stops, back to the track, Kopeeper Durrani and Kamui Kobayashi for Whelan Engineering and Ally Cadillac, respectively. 7:15 in the morning. Joe Bradley, we're turning up the dimmer dial here steadily, more and more brightness appearing, and just once again one of those real atmospheric parts of the race.
Yeah, very much, Johnny. Good morning. Morning, everybody. 7 a.m. just ticked by a whole 15 minutes ago, and it's for me, this is one of the major milestones of this race. It's, you've gotten through the night, you see the sun coming up, it's the most ambient time of any race sunset and sunrise. And you've achieved something, and you get the feeling when you see the sun coming up and the ambient temperature kind of starts to rise, you kind of see that finish line just off in the distance. But what you've got to then reconsider, and you've got to keep telling yourself, there's a full day's work there. There's just under 8.5 hours still of this race to remain, and it's very much not over. And I'll tell you what, Johnny, that LMP2 battle is very much not over, is it? The Olu Shatan, who's just been in the pits and now rejoined the track, just before that pit stop, he managed to get onto the lead lap of the number 8, the Gabriel Aubrey Tower Motorsport Orica, onto the lead lap with that car, and he's going to be chasing that leading LMP2 down. So we keep, I'll keep monitoring that gap and their lap times, because I think that LMP2 battle is hotting up. And, you know, that's not a, not consider what's happening out front, because there's a great battle, a game of poker on the front. I know I call it a high-speed game of chess with regards to the DPIs leading this race, and they are just going out and just hitting their marks and putting in those lap times so consistently. It's incredible. And, Johnny, are you aware that the 31 Wheeling Engineering Cadillac has got a damaged fork? And the team are worried about it. It doesn't seem to have affected, or it certainly didn't seem to have affected Mike Conway's lap times. He was lapping very much in the region of the cars around him. I'm just wondering what people Durrani's now going to make of that damaged underfloor. It's causing a problem with regards to the car's aero performance and the downforce. So that's another one to keep an eye on, just at the front of the field. Nobody began to talk about the TT ranks, have they?
No, we'll have plenty of time to do that. I mean, all classes are doing this, but I've noticed it, I think, more so in the DPI division, that they are just bombing over that first curve at the bus stop, and surely, you know, the under tray of the car will be grounding out as they hit that. So you've got punishment there. You've got other curbs as well around the racetrack, but I think because you're hitting the curb at the bus stop at such high speed and such high ferocity as well, maybe that has created an issue. Maybe it's completely unrelated. It's something that maybe the car's run over and picked up a bit of damage there, which has been made steadily worse. But I suppose Pipo Durrani then getting some experience of exactly how the thing's driving now. It can be described to him in all manner of ways, probably also by Mike Conway, by his radio messages. But until you feel it at first hand, you won't necessarily know how to drive around the problem. The good news is, he does seem to be able to keep pace with those around him, because he's doing about the same sort of lap time as Kamui Kobayashi, who is always a good benchmark, the Japanese. Low 1 minute 37s from Durrani. The second place Acura is just underneath that marker with the 136.9. But there's no indication as yet, Joe, that that's holding Pipo Durrani back at all. My only worry in that regard is that it may be getting steadily worse, and it's a question of, you know, again, how much are you pushing? I mean, Jeremy mentioned this earlier on, we're still at a phase of a race where you're driving within yourself to a degree. These cars are capable of 1 minute 35s, and well, we had to, at the very start of the race, a 134.6, so bear in mind they're about two or three seconds off that. There is more time to find as we get to the really crucial hours of the race, but they've got to make sure at the 31 crew that there's some of that car left by that point.
Well, I got that information from the team, and I'm not sure whether that information is kind of now old, and the team at the time that I was sent that were indeed worried about what effect that damage to the underfloor was going to have, because just looking at Mike Conway's lap times and his average lap time from his previous stints, it didn't seem to have that massive effect. And I'm only comparing it to the cars around him. And at the moment, give you an example, the leader, Renger van der Zander, at the front of the field, 137.2 was his last lap time bike, and Durrani's was a 136.4. So up ahead of him, Castro Neves, 136.9. If anything, he's just put in a quick lap and in all of the top five. So it's not really affecting him that much.
Doesn't seem to
and
be.
And maybe that settled the team's minds.
Well, yeah. And you want to be doing that as much as possible, because they've had a long night already. We'll be on tenterhooks in case they get a last-minute radio message, maybe at Speedway Turn 3 or 4, to say Pipo's got to come in. But that, I mean, underfloor is not something you're going to access quickly, so that would have to be behind the wall job, surely, to get things straightened out. But the signs are good at the moment. I mean, he's only 3/10 of a second off the back of Dane Cameron, so I think the car's fine. But if you were to repair something like that, it's not a quick job, Joe.
Oh, no, mate, that's going to, that is just going to completely take that car out of contention. Right now, I would suggest that car's in contention for the win. Certainly a podium position. You try, and this is, I think, what is the dilemma that the Whelan engineering team had, was they found damage on the floor, would have preferred to have replaced it, because, you know, race engineers and race mechanics, they like a pristine race car, and they like everything to be perfect. Had a already had a qualifying race. We've already had a week of running where things would have been tinkered and tampered with, and set up and reset up. The amount of engineering debriefs that have gone on for hours, in my experience, is no one's business. Where the engineer just, you know, they just can't make that decision on, you know, let's have a, just try a different camber, let's just try a different caster, or whatever that might be. So they wouldn't have been happy with it not being absolutely perfect. However, I think the choice, and the choice that they made, was the right one, because if they had decided, no, let's replace that floor, that car would now be way down the field and out of contention. It's not a quick fix, like you say.
And it's, you know, probably better to get more than one driver into the car so that they can offer some assessment and advice, but... You know, so much of a 24-hour race is, as problems develop, learning how to drive around them, working out how much, if any, time you're losing per lap, and then just living with them. And it's very hard to simulate a broken car in free practice. I suppose you could do it if you rented a track and did a couple of test days and then worked out, you know, which bits you could maybe take off the car and say, well, we can live without that, but really that's an integral piece, so that should be replaced. But very similarly to how mechanics simulate broken cars and how to fix them at speed, I suppose it would pay you to work out which of the bits of the car you could safely run with for several hours. And we're still talking a third of the race here, so there's never a good time for an issue like the 31 has suffered, but you can hear the engine of the 31 in the background now, right behind an LMP2 car. Oh, and I was just wondering whether we might be able to hear some flappage, perhaps, but I think it's more subtle than that, and maybe just a feel of the car's setup that something's not quite right.
It will be very subtle, Johnny. The design, the aero design on the underneath of these cars are actually more important than what we can see, and there will be subtle differences with regards to. I'm not sure, I didn't get the information to where they think the floor was damaged. The floor has been rearranged, and it's the perfectionist attitude that the engineers, the mechanics, have looked at that and gone, the lap floor has been rearranged, that's going to affect our performance. I think that question has been fully answered, though, because that car may lack something somewhere, and the drivers are able to be aware of that. For instance, you know, the car's now got a great turn in, or it's a little bit loose on the throttle application coming out of the infield hairpins. By now, they've got their heads around that, and they're driving around that issue, and it really shows the calibre and the stature of these drivers. They are the best sports car drivers in the world right now, watching here at Daytona, and it doesn't surprise me that they're able to drive around that issue and have now regained that pace, having identified exactly where the problem has lain from whatever it is that's been rearranged on that car.
And now that Pipo has cleared the LMP2 machine, he's right with Dane Cameron now. So this is a good yardstick. Dane, much earlier on in the race, was given some rather second-rate Michelin tyres, purely because he'd been through one stint already, and he ended up with some second-hand rubber. And it was notable in the lap times, but Dane was still pedalling as quickly as he could, but as safely as he could. And again, if you end up with a set of tyres like that, it's really something, once more, that you just have to live with for 20-odd laps in the case of DPI, and then hope that the next time you're in the car, the situation has improved. The 97 Aston Martin stays nice and high and wide at turn 6 to allow the battling DPIs through. Third and fourth positions then for Dane Cameron and Pipo Dirani. And for fear of not giving GT, LM and D any love, then let's give you the order there. Speaking of the 97 Aston Martin, I can tell you that's Ben Keating in the TF Sport Aston in another highlighter yellow liveried car. So yet another version of the British Racing Green, you could argue. They used to be in that very deep, traditional British Racing Green colour. Then there was a slightly lighter shade of that adorned the new Vantage. And I would say that's a different colour again for Car 97 and TF Sports. Obviously, Tom Ferrier deciding to, for the moment, scrap the blood red livery that ran on the number 90 car throughout the World Endurance Championship campaign, won the 24 Hours of Le Mans, and we need to get used to this new livery for Ben Keating, the car that he shares with Richard Westbrook, Charlie Eastwood and Maxwell Root. That car is seventh. Ahead of him on the road is the Pfaff Motorsport Porsche in the plaid colours, so half tartan and half silver. That's the number 9 car. And Matty Campbell, the Australian wizard, is at the wheel of that car, running in sixth. Then it's Jan Halen, fifth, also in a Porsche for Wright Motorsports, car 16. In fourth place, Corey Lewis, Paul Miller Racing's Lamborghini Huracan, last year's winners, running just outside the podium spots right now. Raffaele Marchiello is in third for Sun Energy One in the Mercedes from number 75, metallic blue with the flame effect around the nose. Philip Ellis is driving the Windward Racing Mercedes, car 57, in second. But back to the lead of the class in GT Daytona, Matteo Cressoni for AF Corsa. That's the 21 entry for the scarlet red Ferrari of Cressoni, Simon Mann, Nicholas Nielsen and Daniel Serra. But it's Cressoni who's really impressed me in his stints so far in this race, leading the way by just a second over Philip Ellis. And in GTLM, it's still BMW from Corvette and Corvette, less than a second between each of those cars, and you can lump in James Calado as well, completely nose to tail for Conady Felipe, Antonio Garcia, Tommy Milner and James Calado. And it's Marco Wittmann who was very much with them as well until this pit stop for the 24 BMW. The black M8 GTE has just come in to serve its 19th stop. Corvettes were doing better on fewer pit stops, let's say. Their first and second places, as was the case many hours ago, I thought was a reward for pitting on fewer occasions. But then you look at the 25 BMW, that's done as many as 21 stops, compared to Corvette, who've done 16. The BMW still has the race lead, so that logic can't necessarily be followed. And BMW...
It's that GTLM battle, Johnny, just reminds me of those four cars are just driving through a fist fight for the last hour.
Oh, yeah, completely. It's the same every year, isn't it? It's a smallish class, but always I tend to find the most competitive, Joe.
Absolutely. It's an incredible battle, that. And you can just tell... especially when the stream goes in car and the way that the drivers are driving, they're driving very, very quickly, but they're driving very smoothly. And there's not, if that was a difficult, if once we get into the last hour, let's say, and especially into the last pit stop kind of stint phase, as the BMW peels off now out of the lead of GTLM, Conor De Filippi onto pit road. This is a battle that's going to go right to the very end. And into the pits also is the number 4, Tommy Milner, bringing the Corvette. Have we got Farfus in? Yeah, Farfus has been in and gone out. So that means that the number 3 Corvette will inherit the lead of GTLM. And James Calado in the recent competition, Ferrari, has gone through and will take up that second place. Of course, this will all pan out when we get through this pit stop phase. And we'll see these cars back out. Conor De Filippi. And it's the Corvette that gets off the pit apron first and will overtake the BMW. The BMW a little bit slower in that pit stop, the actual pit stop that took place. So Tommy Milner showing, remaining in the car, didn't quite see if there was any driver changes there on either of those cars. So De Filippi, stays in the BMW number 25, Tommy Milner in the number 4 Corvette, and it's Milner who has made that move while standing still effectively. He took the pit stop and then moved off first, and it was fuel and tyres on the number 4, no driver change for the Corvette, and it was an absolutely choreographed dance around the car that has gotten that number 4 Corvette. It's the silver liveried car. There's a number 3 car is in the usual Corvette yellow. Number 4 that will effectively inherit the lead when we see the two cars running at the front of GTLM take their pit stops. But it was once again proving that long distance sports car racing, it's all about the team. Number 3 Corvette now in, and the Ferrari of Collado in. And let's see if the number 3 Corvette team can do as efficient a job as the number 4 did. Car just taking on fuel. Tyres are done. A little bit of rubbish being scooped from the front grille. That will assist in getting the air to that mid-engine. Corvette. Heritage of that mark. It's now mid-engine. Number 3 off the pit apron. Sure, he's going to steer ahead of the Ferrari of the Rizzi team. So once again, Corvette Racing showing they are indeed a very solid team. And the GTLM pit stop phase is pretty much over. Farfus is out of sequence, in currently running 5th in GTLM. Just on the 2 minutes behind. But we'll see these cars close up back on the track, and we'll see them regain that track position, JP.
Yeah, I noticed as the 3 car headed out again with Tonio Garcia at the wheel. So that wasn't a driver change, was it? Trying to remember now whether Jordan Taylor was at the wheel as it came in, but I think it was Garcia throughout. Davide Rigon has taken charge from James Collado, but I noticed that there's one headlight out on the yellow Corvette, and in Le Mans rules that would need to be fixed, but in the WeatherTech Sports Car Championship, particularly as the night section has almost been completed, I think that's less of a drama, and therefore Corvette didn't address that. I was right in my memory, by the way, that it was BMW winning in 2019 and 2020, so they are on a hat-trick. There's been a drama for the 75 Mercedes. It was nice and high up in the standings in GT Daytona. Now, that, I believe, is an outlap for Kenny Habul, therefore on cold Michelin tyres, and couldn't get the car stopped into the International Horseshoe, so just had to run out a little bit wide onto the grass there, which has cost him some time and quite possibly a position as well. Three of the cars, or all three of the top three, have pitted on the same lap there, including the 21 of Simon Mann. So Mann and Habul in on lap 491. Philip Ellis pitting a lap later, 492, for the windward Mercedes, which therefore leads briefly a lap. Now we've got a battle out on track, because the BMW is having more than a little look around the outside of the number 4 car. This is for, at the moment, third position in GTLM, but bear in mind, Tonio Garcia and Tommy Milner have just rejoined the racetrack, and this is quite possibly Conor DiFilippi's opportunity to get back in front of the Corvettes. He led going into the stops in GTLM. At the moment, looking at losing at least one place. And is that the other Corvette just ahead as well? I believe it is.
Yeah.
So Corvette first and second. And the BMW has suffered a net loss, Jay Bradley, of two places. As now there's an Aston Martin off at the bus stop chicane, together with a Porsche. I think two GT Daytona cars have clashed there on the braking zone on the back straight section.
Yeah, confirm it's the 97, the TF Sport, Aston Martin. Not sure which car they've had it coming together with, but it's into the bus stop chicane on the back straight. Always, always a tricky piece of racetrack, especially to share it with anyone. And that's Porsche number 64. Yes, Porsche number 64 there, coming together with the 97 TF Sport. And again, shared real estate. Oh, the Porsche looked like it was, he didn't turn in. he didn't turn into the first apex. Yeah, he was looked like he was about to straight line. It looks like a bit of damage on the 97 that's going to be making his way to the pit. I think both of those cars got away with that very lightly, Johnny. I think that that 97 Aston, from what I could see, didn't look as though it had been affected too much. But getting back to this GTLM battle, Johnny, the reason we've got the Corvettes out there in front of GTLM right now is down to those guys in the pits. They were outstanding, the pit stops that we saw carried out on the number 3 and 4.
Unbelievable, this battling, and that's pure air effect. It was almost as if the 3 car didn't have a final gear to pull there, but I can assure you it's near enough identical to the number 4, and the benefit that the number 4 car had was that massive hole punched in the air by the 3, all of the wind resistance being caught by the leading car at the time, which was Antonio Garcia, and he had little choice but to allow Tommy Milner around the outside. Or was there a clever little bit there of maybe feathering of the throttle, realising that Tommy Milner's got slightly the quicker car in this phase of the race? You allow him to go, try and let him pass, but not the BMW at the same time, and potentially build a gap for the silver Corvette. It was tough to call that, Joe. Meanwhile, the 97 Aston Martin has reached pit road again. A chance to describe it to you from another angle, this time as the cars go into the bus stop from behind those cars. And it was just a missed braking point, I think, for the 64. Let me tell you who's driving that. Just no opportunity to turn in. Realising, I think, that there was a car to be battling with, but the opportunity to turn in was sadly missed. For Ted Giovannis, the man we were hearing from right here on RS2 IMSA Radio earlier on in the broadcast. So Ted sadly had to come into pit road with, I guess, a damaged Porsche. And likewise, at least the 97 was dragging something, probably a part of its splitter, on the ground. So that's going to be looked at by TF Sport. And actually, Ben's back in the session now, Ben Keating, back in the race for the 97 car. So I reckon TF Sport have turned that car around pretty quickly.
There's a lot happening at that point, Johnny, into the braking area. It's a very, very high-speed turn-in, and it's a left-right followed by a right-left. And the right-left exit is pretty flat out, so you try to scrub off as little speed as possible, and we saw there, I'm not sure whether that was the Aston trying to go around the outside of the Porsche or the Porsche down the inside of the Aston, but it's not uncommon to see that. There's nothing out of character there, seeing an incident like that at the bus stop, and hopefully we'll see both of those cars rejoin without too much of a delay. Back to GTLM, though, this is a quality fist fight. Do these guys know that there's 8 hours of this to go? Can they keep this up? This is mega.
Of course they do. Of course they do. And of course they can. They do it year in, year out. And Corvette, after such a strong championship year in 2020, with a brand new car, let's not forget, look like they're going to continue in this championship where they left off at the back end of the previous season. But BMW very much taking the fight to the well-known American brand. So you've got the German BMW squad, the Corvette crew from very much from the USA, and then the Ferrari of Italy, represented by American squad Ricci Competizione. Porsche are there as well. Okay, not with the factory cars, but there is an ex-factory Porsche in the hands of WeatherTech Racing as well. Get used to this, because it will be this frenetic, I get the feeling, all the way to the flag. We're moments away from the 16th hour being completed. You're tuned to IMSA Radio, part of the Radio Show Limited network of channels. Remember, you can get in touch using the handle at IMSA Radio and the hashtag R24 Radio, R24 Radio. And Joe Bradley and myself, Johnny Palmer, in the Haggerty Global Broadcast Centre. It is time, therefore, for a racing update, a Mazda in-race update, which sees Renger van der Zande in the Cadillac DPI lead on 535 laps by 4.7 seconds over Elio Castroneves in the best of a couple of Acuras. The first from Konica Minolta Acura, car number 10 running in second, and 3 seconds adrift is the Meyershank Racing example with Kerb Agajanian and the Dane Cameron car, number 63rd. Then, just a couple of feet away, really, from the tail of that Acura is the next of the Cadillacs, Pipa Derani, in the wheel and engineering number 31. Damaged floor or not, that's going very strongly. Allied Cadillac Racing represented by the 48 car of Kamui Kobayashi. And then a couple of laps down from the DPI leaders, Oliver Jarvis in the Mazda Motorsports DPI car 55. Four LMP2s come next. Gabby Obrey in the 8 Tower Motorsport Orica. Paul-Luc Chatin for Era Motorsport. Same type of chassis car 18. And again, another Orica for Devlin DiFrancesco. And Dragon Speed number 82 is third, ahead of the RWR Eurasia number 51 car, which is being driven by Cody Ware. Don't really need to remind you of the order for GTLM because they're completely together and it's likely to change at any moment, but I'll give it you anyway. Tommy Milner leads in the number 4 Corvette. Tonio Garcia glued to his rear tailpipes in the 3 Corvette. Then Conor DiFilippi just a few metres behind in the red BMW. And Davide Rigon is a massive 6 seconds adrift of that top three, but looking to get involved as soon as possible. Augusto Farfa's slightly more distant. He's over a minute adrift now in the 24 BMW, the black one. LMP3 is led by Oliver Askew for Riley Motorsports, the 74 Ligier, leading Joao Barbosa in another Ligier for Sean Creech Motorsport, number 33. And in GT Daytona, it's now Mauro Engel for Windward Racing in a Mercedes, number 57, leading the AF Corsa Ferrari of Simon Mann, 21. Kenny Habul, despite that grass track moment, is still in third in the 75 Sun Energy 1 Mercedes. And then it's a Lamborghini from Paul Miller Racing, fourth, car 1, and Jan Halen in the best of the Porsches for Wright Motorsports, car 16, despite that damage it incurred in the night when it arrived at turn 1 backwards, having had some contact. That is the latest Mazda in-race update, and there are now just under 8 hours to go.